Sounds to Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Medievalist Jenna Matthews is back to talk about Brand's third POV chapter. I found our conversation about symbolism fascinating. I hope you do too. Steve and I talk a little bit about spiders toward the end of our conversation. If you're arachnophobic, definitely skip the last 5 minutes of that. Also, Jan Doodle Wilson. My short conversation with her is in place of my usual bird's eye view. We compare Bran's characterization in the show with Dany's ultimate outcome. So don't confuse her. Don't confuse Jan with Janna. Two different professors. So, without further ado, here is Bos Mang Aeron.
Ask Aeron anything!
Best first seasons ever ranked, all right? Game of Thrones, The Wire, Breaking Bad, Stranger Things, or The Leftovers? Just the first season.
Damn. Well, I mean, The Leftovers is my current reigning number one on the Mount Rushmore television for me. So, like, and I thought season one was particularly fascinating because of my experience with cults and dealing, like, losing a mother to one and all that kind of stuff. So, like, it's kind of cheating to throw that in. But, like, most others, it's like a conversation because Breaking Bad, excellent, but was kind of cut short by the writer's strike and wasn't a fully formed season, right? So it's got that dragging it back.
Oh, I didn't know that about Breaking Bad.
Yeah, it's only like 7 episodes long.
It's still pretty awesome. 7 episodes, but
and it's actually kind of good because, like, if not been for the writer's strike, Jesse Pinkman probably would have died that first season.
Oh, really?
Because it was during the shutdown and editing of the season one that, like, Gilligan and company were like, man, we really got something with this Aaron Paul kid. We should find a way to, like, give him more stuff to do. So, like, yeah. The Wire is just, I mean, it's an amazing, flawless season of television.
Isn't Wire your favorite show?
The Leftovers dethroned it. I think The Wire, yeah. And then what were the others?
So Game of Thrones, Wire, yeah. Breaking Bad, Stranger Things, Leftovers.
Stranger Things is real good too, but it's like it's one of those things where it's not as serious. So, like, I find that, like, things that are more serious tend to get that extra weight. So I mean, Game of Thrones is probably in the top three of The Wire and The Leftovers, and I'm bumping Breaking Bad out of that because it was strike shortened. And I still didn't feel like, you know, Breaking Bad hadn't achieved the high. Like, Breaking Bad season one is the shuttle that just jettisoned off the boosters, right? The booster rockets. It hadn't achieved orbit yet. It hadn't gotten to where it needed to be. Whereas Leftovers is a standalone. Like, season one could have been it, and that would have been a perfect season of television in my mind.
I felt with both The Wire and Leftovers, it took me a while to get into the season. Like, by the time it was, like,
I thought the same thing about Game of Thrones.
I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. But it was really kind of a slog for me with both those shows to get into the middle of the first season.
I thought the same thing about Game of Thrones because I didn't read the books before I saw the first episode, the first season. I read, like, up through book three between seasons one and two, and then I read the others between season two and three. So, like, I found the first going of Game of Thrones very, like, who is this fucker with the stones on his eyes? Who are these people? Why is it a big deal that they're having sex? Oh, they're brothers and sisters. Oh, this other guy is their brother. Like, it took me, like, The Wire is a very good example. And like, honestly, like, The Expanse, it took me 3 or 4 episodes to where I felt like I was in the world because they both have similar styles. Like, David Simon doesn't care if you don't know who these people are. He just trusts that if you give it time and you kind of let it yourself absorb into his world, that you'll get it. And he doesn't want fans that don't take that effort. So,
but
I think it's like, it's, but that's the thing. It's like, it's really hard for me to talk about individual seasons and, like, crowning them and stuff. But I would say that those three are kind of like, maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's actually just down to, Nah, I don't know. I don't know, because like Leftovers, Game of Thrones, and The Wire all have extremely fascinating first seasons.
For me, Stranger Things and Game of Thrones are kind of on par for the best, I think. For first season, that first episode of Game of Thrones, I thought, I'm hooked. I'm reading all these books. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how fast it hooked me.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
You're like, maybe you like the pulp a little bit more than the...
I do.
The prestige.
I don't know, man. That's a good question. But I'm all in for pulp. There's no doubt about that.
I do too. But the thing is like, but I do have that bias. Like, I don't take it as serious. I know that for Bald Move purposes, we classify Game of Thrones under the pulp because it's got dragons and magic and shit. But like, it certainly carries itself as a more prestige.
Oh, for sure.
Although that first season was like, they really leaned into the sex position and stuff. Like, yeah, that became less a part of Game of Thrones as it went on, but that season one's pretty gonzo when it comes to, you know.
And you could point to 14 HBO first seasons that are like that.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Let's stay on the topic of pulp here. Is The Terminator good?
The Terminator, the movie?
Yeah. Is it good?
I think it's good.
When's the last time you watched it?
Probably 10 years ago. Uh-huh. I've seen Terminator 2 as recently as like 3 months ago because I sat down and made my son watch it.
Very, very much a different movie. All right, let me ask you that. All right, is The Terminator 2 good?
Terminator 2 is one of the finest action movies made.
Okay. All right.
Like The Predator. And now the thing is I just watched The Predator this summer, and there's a lot of stuff in The Predator that doesn't necessarily hold up culturally. But on the other hand, you know, do I think the military men in the 80s actually had some homophobia and, you know, some kind of like jokes at the expense of the feminine? Abso-fucking-lutely. Yeah. So like, it does.
Jesse the
Body holds up that way.
It's probably not someone you want to emulate.
Yeah, those guys are not, but they're, you know, they're held out to be kind of like these kind of bad dudes, you know.
I feel like let's say I go back and watch something like Alien. I feel like
Alien holds up.
This holds up. There's no doubt about it. I go back to The Terminator and thinking it's still fun for nostalgia's sake, but there are some still brilliant things about the movie. But there's some really cringy stuff in that movie.
There is. What do you think of? Okay, let me. Here's the. What do you think about The Thing? Because I think The Thing holds up like a champ, even if the practical effects don't quite work, because they're so insane and over the top that they're kind of like a spectacle in itself. Whereas, you know, when Arnold's standing in front of a mirror, digging out bullets in front of his out of his face and tearing his eyeball out. Like, that's just pretty clearly a borderline papier-mâché head that they're working on, you know? Like, that's not, like, seven dogs stitched together with a squid and a crocodile mouth in the middle of it. Like, I know what people's faces look like, and, you know?
I have never seen The Thing. Yeah, I know.
Well, that's another one. I would love to see if you watch, because I never either until I watched it for some Bald Move thing, and I was just blown away by how well it all worked. I would love to see your opinion on whether it works.
Give that one a try.
If you have a question for Aaron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jana Matthews, welcome back. I feel like I could just have you on every week, and I would look forward to it, and we would all learn something that we didn't know before.
Wow, the feeling is mutual. I've been really anticipating this conversation, and I'm so happy to be here.
All right, so I got really excited when I learned about this ancient medieval Welsh story about Bran the Blessed.
Yeah. So, right. So he was a mythological king that, you know, that it circulated in like Welsh mythology, and also, you know, because of its proximity to England, you know, did come up and show up in various allusions to Knights of the Round Table. So it's part of that whole sort of larger tradition.
Right.
Right. His name does mean like crow, or and crow and raven are kind of interchangeable terms that we see there. They're obviously like they're different species. A raven is much larger than a crow, but both of them have essentially the same function. There's also a connection between this section in story and the crow, and also sort of Viking and Old Norse mythology as well. So there's definitely an intersection between like Bran the Blessed and between sort of the symbolism and iconography of the crow / raven.
I mean, there are certain creatures that seem to lend themselves to stories and mythologies. And like, for instance, like sometimes a stag is like a messenger from the other side or something like
that.
Is the crow or the raven, does it evoke that kind of magical imagination as well?
Oh, 100%. And that's essentially its function within all forms of mythology, but particularly in like in Old Norse mythology. So in that theological or mythological tradition, Odin, is a god. He has two ravens that he sends out that sort of search the earth and sort of serve as his messengers. And so we have a link there between that and like in the Game of Thrones at the little birds, you know, who kind of get sent and sort of circulate around and are always kind of present. And then also in Game of Thrones, we do have the ravens that show up and that are listening on the doorsteps or in the windowsills. So that's definitely where that's pulled from. Ravens and crows, they're, you know, kind of, I mean, for, I don't want to collapse them for any, you know, bird experts out there, but, you know, essentially serve the same purpose in the sense that they're creatures that prey on or that live on carcasses and carrion or the dead. And so they were believed to be animals that float that inhabit both worlds, that can float sort of seamlessly between the living and the dead.
So
thus, like, you know, Bran is exactly one of those figures. It's appropriate that his name means crow or raven, and because he is a figure that hovers between the living and the dead, in so many ways.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, this is very helpful to me. And let me just do a quick synopsis of the chapter, and then we can kind of delve more deeply into that.
Yeah.
So here's my synopsis. Bran is dreaming and he knows it. As he falls, he's discussing his situation with a crow. The crow urges him to fly, not cry. Bran believes that he will wake just before he hits the ground. He sees a golden face, he sees Winterfell from above, he sees several family members and friends, and he catches the gaze of the Heart Tree. He sees several characters in the distant south. He sees Vaes Dothrak, he sees the Jade Sea, Ashai, which is pregnant with dragons. He looks north and sees Jon, he looks beyond the wall to the tundras of ice, and then finally, he sees the curtain at the end of the world, and he stares into the heart of winter. The crow, which now has three eyes, stabs his forehead. He wakes up and sees that his wolf has grown. Rob greets him, and Bran tells him that his wolf is named Summer. It's such a huge chapter. I mean, only a few pages.
Yeah, for sure. There's so much going on in this particular section.
There's this scope that Martin can use Bran's, I don't know, green scene for. And all of a sudden, you know, we're really, you know, we're in the narrative, we're tinkering around with like Sansa's bruised ego and Arya's, you know, sense of loss. And, you know, it can all be viewed as a very sort of minute issues. And then you get to this chapter and it's like, oh no, this thing is like global. This is like the scope is huge. And it's kind of foreshadowing what a lot of characters, where they will go and where they are right now. And so, guest choice, would you be interested in talking about a plot point, a character, a theme, or shall we just climb the ladder of chaos?
Let's just climb the ladder of chaos. I'm a risk taker here.
Good. I'm glad. There's so much I want to know.
So I, what's so interesting about it from a reader perspective, and maybe this just reveals me to be a bad slash lazy reader, where when I'm normally reading a novel and you have, it's very action paced and the plot is moving along and this is a cerebral passage and a cerebral chapter that doesn't seem to have any real relation to anything. And so the normal instinct as a reader, at least the kind of reader that I am, is just to skip it, right? Yeah. It's like there's nothing going on here, right? This is just like, you know, the dream is a dream, like whatever. Yeah. And kind of like a filler chapter. And I think that again, like if you are that kind of reader and if you're that kind of viewer who sort of sees Bran and it's just like, all right, well, you know, there's got to be some like mystical person in here who, you know, thinks he wants to play God or has some sort of connection with the other world, you tend to overlook those figures. And if you do that, then you, you know, as you find out much later on, like you've made a crucial error.
The first time I read through this book, and I remember very distinctly thinking, oh no, not Bran again. Like I was just so bored with the Bran chapters. And I think you're totally right. I feel like because it's such a departure from the things that I've been taught to care about in the book. Mm-hmm. And because there's so much going on here that I don't quite understand yet. My tendency was always to kind of try to speed read through these chapters to try to get to something that I really cared about, you know? So yeah, I totally had that experience.
I think what's interesting is that if you think about Martin as being really this antiquarian, like medievalist historian, is probably the best way of thinking about it, is that, you know, he reads like an historian and he writes like an historian, and as a medievalist, you know, one of the things that we're taught is that page space is at a premium because you're writing, you know, everything's handwritten on animal parchment. And so there's not this sense of like cut out this passage because it's extraneous. So everything that's in there is there for a reason and it's there intentionally. Hmm. And I think that Martin plays that same game or takes a page from that. So we have to really, you know, to skip over this as sort of a reminder that like he's kind of testing our medieval sensibilities and saying, are you like, it's here for a reason. It's not just, you know, to make the book, you know, 20 pages longer.
I was wondering a little bit about that, but let me circle back to it. All right. Number one, let's go back to the bird, the carrion symbolism.
Mm-hmm. They just show up and they're kind of there. And so what their specific names, you know, symbolize thought and memory or mind. And so when you're talking about that fluidity and, you know, the fluidity of Bran's state as he is falling, right? It's very much a liminal state. You're neither on the ground or in the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. He's in a dream, which is an in-between state. You're neither awake nor asleep. He also is paralyzed at this point, right? So he's neither like fully able-bodied, nor is he dead. And so he, you know, that is a sort of...
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of the characters view him kind of like on death's door, right?
Yeah, totally, right. I mean, and so his whole existence from this point going forward is really like absolutely in this like liminal space where he's not really grounded and he's not really, you can't really place him anywhere. And so similarly with the crow and the raven, you know, it's part of what the raven is doing in this passage, or I mean this chapter, is that he's giving him, you know, it takes place in sort of ultimatums, right? It's either you die or you fly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so here are to you live or you die, right? Essentially is what he's saying. And kind of the in-between option he's giving him is like living through flying, you know, to like permanently inhabit this space, you know? And so for Bran, like there really is up until this point, it's either alive or dead.
And he's being pressured. I mean, I guess he's being encouraged to become something else, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or realize that he is something else. Like he's certain that he's a boy who's dreaming. And this voice from the other side is trying to tell him, well, you're more than what you think you are, in other words.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And this is this crucial moment of Bran has to decide whether or not he's going to listen to the messenger, or if he's going to disregard him. And then what that means, you know, gaining the confidence, like, and it's sort of a test, right? If he chooses to listen to the crow, which he does, then that proves himself as a worthy receptacle of continued information and access and like sort of the mythological sense to the gods.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I am super appreciative of the way that Martin is using dreams, because I really feel quite annoyed with this sort of lazy storytelling technique where people remember something that happened earlier in their life and they're remembering in a dream state, and then they wake up, and that's the way that the storyteller can kind of give you a little bit of backstory. Mm-hmm. But it's totally lazy, because that's not how dreams work. I mean, you might process memories in sort of weird ways, but you don't actually remember things as they were in your dreams. And I see this so often in storytelling, where people use dreams in ways that dreams don't really actually work. But Martin fall into that trap. He's using Bran's dream here to kind of tell us about his current state rather than his backstory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I guess I just really appreciated the way he was able to do that. And, you know, all that is to say that I appreciate it, you know, this reading. I don't know if I appreciated it so much the first time.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes dreams are used to tell the past, recall the past, and this one is used to push the narrative forward, which is a profound literary difference.
Yeah. I'm going to read this little section here. The crow landed on his hand and began to eat. "Are you really a crow?" Bran asked. "Are you really falling?" the crow asked back. "It's just a dream," Bran said. "Is it?" asked the crow. "I'll wake up when I hit the ground," Bran told the bird. "You'll die when you hit the ground," the crow said. It went back to eating corn. Okay, I got two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, did this remind you of Bran's interactions with Maester Lewin later on, where Lewin's always trying to tell Bran, it's just a dream is just a dream. A dream is just a dream. It almost seems like a little parallel here.
Yeah, no, I didn't think about that, but now that you mention it, right, that does absolutely play out in interesting ways. Tell me more.
Okay, well, I really liked that. Lewin is almost a stand-in for sort of the, yeah, like, non-supernatural, you know, scientifically minded person, and in many ways, he's a stand-in for the modern reader, right? And one of the first things that Bran has to figure out is that his dreams are not really dreams, because he has these kind of dreams and he has wolf dreams. And one of the things that he sees happening toward the end of this book is that he dreams that he sees his father in the crypts of Winterfell.
Mm.
And Rickon has the same dream. And of course, Lewin is trying to explain that, you know, your father's alive. Don't worry. He's not in the crypt. A dream is just a dream. But here we go, you know, super early in the book. Here we are. Bran is being told specifically by the crow that this is not just a dream. That was my first.
Yeah.
My first observation. Okay, here, now I need your help. Is this corn thing out of place? My impression is that corn is a North American crop. And in the medieval world, they wouldn't have known what corn was. Did that strike you as misplaced?
Yeah, and no, it's 100% misplaced. And I don't know. You know, maybe we're reading too much in terms of what Martin is doing or not doing. But for sure, yeah, it was there was no corn.
So I looked up. I looked up, like, when was corn first introduced to Europe?
Like 16th century, right?
Yeah, it's almost like it was one of the first things that Columbus brings back,
mm-hmm,
with,
mm-hmm,
him. So it's like 1493 or something like that. But I mean, there's no way it would have been widely used.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe I'm nitpicking or whatever, but it did kind of strike me as, why corn, Martin?
Yeah. So the only thing I can think of is, and this feels like if this is what Martin meant, like a particularly bad choice, just given all the other terms that you could use. But I mean, there is this colloquial sense in the Middle Ages and early modern period that, like, corn stands in for just a general category of field crop.
Oh,
and
interesting.
So it can, like, you know, so oftentimes you might refer it to wheat or to barley or to other kinds of things. But still, like, given its sort of specific historical like register, it feels like that he should have just said wheat or barley if that's what he meant.
Yeah, see, I guess I shouldn't. I mean, there's zombies in this story, so I shouldn't be too, I know. Too critical. No,
right. But like, if this feel that feels like, a, given all the other things that he gets right. Yeah, right. Like the depth of even the symbolism of Bran. Right. It feels like a mistake.
Oh goodness. Now, so we already touched a little bit on Norse mythology with the crow imagery, right? Mm-hmm. Tell me about this vision of kind of this curtain at the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
This seems connected to the Norse cosmology, where there actually is sort of like this
end of the world,
this edge, right?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So I think, you know, maybe say one more thing about the dream vision, and the dream vision is a really, really common, trope and stylistic device used throughout the Middle Ages and medieval literature across Europe. One of the most common, that and the frame narrative, right? So Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is frame narrative, a story within a story, right? This is also a story within a story, this whole book, but dreams do have tremendous significance. They're not viewed as jokes in the Middle Ages. They're very much opportunities by which human, like the earth, people in the human world can commune with and have and receive inspiration from other worlds, right? And the other thing is that dreams also allow a certain level of play, because it is in this, as we remember, we started out in this sort of nebulous, fluid sphere of existence. You're allowed to have things happen in dreams like that can't really happen in real life. And so, you know, thus we have a crow talking to a young boy and him flying, you know, and like all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it allows an alternative world to be built that is simultaneously held by and has meaning within the real world, but is not held to the kind of temporal constraints that the world would demand. So you simultaneously can have, and what we do have here are visions and sights and images of things that are serious and that are real and that you can see and that have meaning and context within the real world, but also at the same time have like a boy who's flying and talking to a crow, right? And both of those things can be true. So when you're talking about the end of the world, right, in Norse mythology, and you know, the world, you know, in human existence ends in this massive battle that the gods and the humans and the giants and all sorts of living creatures participate in, called Ragnarok. And that is a gigantic battle where everyone essentially kind of kills each other, and then with very few survivors, and the survivors go on to kind of create new worlds. And so this sense of, and I think that's important because it kind of pushes against the like Judeo-Christian kind of mythology of like the, you know, similarly like ends in a big battle, right, and not everybody dies, right? Like there's a winner and somebody emerges victorious, and here like everyone dies, you know? And so there's that sense of like, right, like as you described it, as the cliff at the end of the world, where like there is no hero or villain, everyone is, it's just done. And that I think is very much like, maybe also gets worked its way in here when you think about dying. I mean, this is a theory, right? Like when he's thinking about the choice between fly or die, like death doesn't provide an alternative here, doesn't provide an alternative sphere by which you can, you know, another kind of life. It's over.
Right.
And so there's added level of stakes here, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, if we think of it in term, now, of course, Martin's going to play with this idea of, you know, sort of the undead marching south, sure, right? But if, you know, we're not told what Bran sees that kind of, you know, chills him and frightens him, that's beyond the edge of the world. But I think it's safe to assume that he sees sort of some sort of symbolic realm of death or something like that, which is exactly what he's staring down at the ground, if he hits the ground, right? So that may be sort of a microcosm, macrocosm thing happening, where Bran is maybe personally contending with the possibility of death, like he might be in between life and death. But with his green sight, he can see all the way north to see this massive event that's sort of right on the horizon that also represents death.
Mm-hmm. This is a complex passage. I mean, our complex chapter that I think is really tricky, and I'm sort of simultaneously stuck between am I overreading or underreading here? Right. And maybe that's part of the beauty of it.
So there's this statement where, okay, it's this part of the dream where he sees a bunch of symbols. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should just read it. One shadow was dark as ash with the terrible face of a hound. Another was armored like the sun, golden and beautiful. Over them both loomed a giant in armor made of stone. But when he opened his visor, there was nothing inside but darkness and thick black blood. Okay. So contextually, Bran has seen a bunch of people he knows. So he's seen like Jon Snow. He's seen his brother. He's seen his mother. And so we're getting a sense that he's seen real people. Mm-hmm. And then we get these symbols, because I guess Bran doesn't have a good idea of who these people are. He's just describing what he's seen. Terrible face of a hound. I'm assuming that that's the hound, right? Armor like the sun, golden and beautiful. That sounds like Jaime Lannister. I'm guessing at this point. But then over them looms a giant made of stone. But when he opened his armor, there was nothing inside but darkness and thick black blood. Who do you think the giant is?
So that was interesting, because when I was reading those passages or that same symbolism, I you can for sure attach them to specific individuals, and it makes sense given the fact that he's immediately kind of gone through his family and his friends. Mm-hmm, again. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that they'd be referring to specific people. But I think the fact that they were deep, they were not given a specific fate. Like, I guess there was a terrible face of the hound, but the other one is sort of a shadow, and the other one is a figure that's armored, that's sort of empty. Yeah. I took them more of just in a generalized sense about kind of the danger that lurks, in the world outside of his family. And sure. As far as the giant armor made of stone.
I think I like that interpretation better than anything I found. I kind of jumped on a couple of fan forums.
Yeah.
And some people are saying it's Gregor. Some people say it's Littlefinger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's, this is sort of a stand-in for the Titan of Braavos. Mm-hmm. And some people say it's Tyrion, because the black brotherhood is like, they have black blood. There's like a symbol that they use for that, and maybe Tyrion at some point will join their ranks or something. I didn't find any of those compelling.
Yeah,
and it's so vague to me that it sounds like maybe it's not a who, maybe it's a what. So your interpretation would be like, it's kind of this ominous looming danger that's kind of overshadowing everything.
Well, if you look at the line before that, it says there were shadows all around them.
Yeah.
And so I think the point of a shadow is that, this is at least how I interpret it, right? Like, shadow obscures and hides identity. It also can, it also reveals things or makes things appear that they're seem as if they're there, but they're not.
Yeah.
And so, it can be a metaphor, a symbol of just fear itself, a fear of anxiety. Like, every, things that lurk in the shadows are things real and also imagined. And so it's just sort of like, I sort of took it as this like looming dread that kind of comes and lurks, but it doesn't really inhabit a body yet. Or one that you can identify.
Yeah.
And all of these figures are obscured, like you can't see their faces. They're not described even as fully human. Right, the blood of a hound. Even we know we learn later. Okay, that's a real person, but still, at this point, it's just this vague amorphous body.
Yeah, right. And it's symbolism, right? But
yeah,
like you were saying before, Martin chooses, seems to be choosing his words pretty carefully. And this is a pretty tightly, I feel like it's a pretty tight novel. I don't feel like there are many sort of stray plots that don't go anywhere, little details that are not for a purpose. So the fact that he included it here makes me wonder, well, he's pointing to something, and it just isn't really clear to me right now what that is.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me do some notable introductions in the chapter. There's several geographic areas that we're hearing for the first time. Like, for instance, he sees to the Jade Sea and to Ashai, which he interprets as sort of a volcanic area, but underneath the ground is dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're kind of getting a little bit of Martin's mythology there for the first time. In addition to that, it's possible that we're seeing this, you know, certain characters represented that we haven't really met yet, you know, depending on how we interpret this giant character. And then book versus show differences. I think that the one thing that you could say here is that one of the virtues of the show is that it has those opening credits with basically the map of Westeros and Essos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so every single time you revisit the show, you have the option to kind of survey the geography of this hybrid setting. You don't get that with the book. And this chapter almost functions a little bit like that, those opening credits. Because through Bran's point of view, you could really get the sense of the vast geography, really the map of this story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this chapter is not really represented in the show, but it kind of is a stand-in for those opening credit, you know, castle sequences.
Yep. I love that. I love the way of thinking about that. Really great.
Have you ever had a falling dream?
I have had a falling dream, and they're scary as heck. I
mean, did you wake up before you hit the ground?
I did.
Were you actually falling out of bed or anything like that?
No, I just feel like I'm falling off a cliff. And, you know, and so I think what's so interesting about this chapter is that it's playing on such a common trope. And then there's always that kind of cultural myth. I don't even know if it's true or not, that if you hit the ground, you know, that's, it cannot be true, right? But like,
hit the ground in your dream, you'll actually die.
Yeah. And I that does not make any sense. But I think what's happening here is that he has this, you know, this dream that he's having, but he's also, this is also the moment when he wakes up, right, kind of for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a dream, but it's also like something much, much, much deeper than that too. It's not just like I'm taking a nap and I've had this dream. It's like, you know, he's in this space, of like liminality, like really and truly between life and death. Or we don't know how long.
Yeah, I took it when the crow says, if you hit the ground, you're going to die. I think that that's sort of, as a reader, I was kind of interpreting that as, you're that close to death.
Yeah.
Like you are really in between right now. And yeah. This may well result in your death unless you can learn how to fly.
Yep.
And that could just be interpreted as, you know, waking up or whatever. But it also, we know that it also has some connection to his, you know, his sort of future self.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Yeah, all of the above.
I used to have a recurring falling dream nightmare when I was a kid. And it was like almost like out of like a 1930s movie without any kind of sound. There was like this evil villain with like a horrible mustache, and he tied me to the top of a ladder, and then the ladder fell and was going to hit this body of water. I must have had that dream a dozen times when I was a kid. And every time I woke up before hit the water, but for whatever reason, a recurring nightmare about falling. So I don't know what that means. Can you help me?
It means me. I was going to say, I'm like, maybe your brand, maybe the crows are going to come talk to you pretty soon, right? Because you're sort of in that same liminal stage. Maybe you didn't pass the test and right, therefore weren't able to rise to the occasion.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Steve, this episode starts with the Greyjoys killing all of the ravens.
Yeah.
They're dumping these messengers, these probably very friendly, intelligent animals. They're just dumping corpses right out the window.
Yeah. Well, the thing is they feel that the ravens are the mainstream media and they're the enemy of the Greyjoys. And they're just, you know, this is their nod to fake news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I thought that was an interesting way to begin because there's a lot of lack of information that's happening. I got a few things that are mentioned in this episode. First, Tywin thinks that Jaime is Rob's prisoner.
Right.
He doesn't have all of the information yet.
No.
And Rob thinks that the Lannisters have his sisters. In other words, the Lannisters have Arya.
Right.
And you could say that they do. I mean, Tywin does technically have Arya.
But he also thinks that Bran and Walnut Boy are prisoners.
For sure, Kat and Rob think that Bran and Rickon, or as he's known, Walnut Boy.
Ricky Walnuts.
Ricky Walnuts. There was a lesser known gangster in Godfather 3. No one really saw Godfather 3 all the way through, but there is a Ricky Walnuts. It's just a force to be reckoned.
Everybody knows Ricky Walnuts. His brother's got no legs. I mean, he's got legs. They just don't work.
All right. So, yeah. So, we have less information. However, we meet a character named Lord of Bones.
Oh, yeah.
And he happens to know that Ned's dead.
Yeah.
So, that news has spread.
Yeah. So, but I mean, there's been some time.
There's been a little time since the end of season one.
Right. I mean, there's been some time for things to get out to the Lord of Bones. We don't know what the Lord of Bones networking system is quite yet.
They're like, the Wildlings have like, they have a different Netflix menu. And they will eventually get what we get early on in Southern Westeros.
I feel like they play some hard rock gigs like in town. Kind of like a Gwar like band, and so when they're there, you know, as they're packing up their equipment at the end, everyone's just, oh, did you hear about Ned? Ned's dead, man.
Now, Lord of Bones, he's not only wearing a hat, he's wearing a face mask.
Yeah, he's like if Freddy and Jason were to work together.
He's like they had a baby.
That's right. Lord
of Bones. Lord of Bones is the love child of Freddy and Jason.
Yep. It all makes sense now.
Oh, my goodness. So Lord of Bones can be talked into keeping John alive.
Yeah.
Apparently. Did you buy that whole thing? I had a couple problems with the North of the Wall sequence.
Yeah, I mean, it was, this is one of those that feels like a means to an end plot mover.
Yeah. My big problem was, okay, you're whispering as you're walking, mm-hmm. and the guy is right behind you. I mean, maybe that, like, bone face? Maybe that's like...
It's like a Batman... It's like when you hear about, like, the Batman cowl from, like, Michael Keaton. He's just like, it made it impossible to turn your head. You couldn't hear out of the
thing. You couldn't hear anything.
Super impractical. Right. And, like, Lord of Bones is like, look, I know how cool it looks, all right? But there's certain things you have to give.
So then Corrin Halfhand pushes him down the slope or whatever. And Ygritte's just eating it up. She's just like... Oh, now I can trust him because he's in a fight with this other Night's Watch member. Yeah. I think that she's really smart, and it's hard to believe that she's being fooled by this.
Yeah. In fact, my expectation was that she would be like, see through it.
Yeah.
And so any notion that she wasn't, I was kind of like, I feel like we've just sort of watered down this.
Although, Steve, we've all known really intelligent people who make bad decisions when they fall in love.
It's fair. Yeah, you see what you want to see, what you're saying.
So like maybe, Sam. Yeah. Like Sam, we're on the record for saying that Sam is acting like a dummy. Actually, Sam is fairly intelligent, but a girl has never given him the time of day, and as soon as one does,
yeah,
then he's a dummy.
Right. No, and that's fair. And I think, you know, I feel like you just talked yourself into that scene, which is probably good.
Yeah, I did. And maybe I'm in love. I'm in love with this show. And so I just, yeah, I'm making poor decisions. So yeah, exactly.
There you go. No, and but I think that's, you see, I mean, and speaking of love, I mean, what a great scene between Rob and, what's her name?
Talisa,
yeah. I mean, that was a great, like, it was like kind of like a nice little, the drop of water that we talked about when you're in a desert of tension, yeah. Right? And so like when he has that moment, I don't want to marry the Lady Frey. It's just.
Okay, well. I'm glad you enjoyed the scene. I had problems with it.
Okay.
My main problem being when she walks in the tent, that flap is wide open.
Oh, yeah. Well.
And I'm just thinking, I'm not a big fan of overt displays of affection on this show. A lot of times because they're gross. Anytime Littlefinger is doing a voiceover.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, so this one did not have a Littlefinger voiceover. However,
it felt like it could have.
It felt like it could have, and I'm just thinking, like, I'm watching these two fall in love, and it's very compelling. I'm sold on this. I'm sold that they've fallen in love. They've actually, I think that the showrunners have done enough work to sort of make this affair believable.
Yeah.
But I'm just sitting there thinking, close the flap!
Yeah.
Close the flap on the tent!
I had that moment, and then I was also kind of like, I mean, you're the king.
Exactly. That's the baller move to say, look, I'm a, such a different class. Leave that it the actually flap doesn't matter. Yes, leave the flap open. I don't get that sense from Rob, though.
No, but I also get the sense that, like, he wasn't thinking of, well, I was. It's a weird thing to say given the scene, but I don't think he was thinking of flaps.
Flaps in the Spinal Tap sense?
Yeah.
So, I just, look, I believe that they love each other. That's fine. I just closed the flap on the tent, and you sold me. Now, here's the other option. It could be that Rob's got a guard out there, and as soon as the guard sees what's happening, he, like, closes the flap door for him.
Right.
But isn't that a little bit creepy? Like, you got a wingman that's closing the door behind your girlfriend? That's a little creepy.
Well, I mean, you get the hand of the king.
I guess to each their own. I mean, as long as we're all consenting adults, I suppose I shouldn't judge.
Hope it's a lovely bridge.
This episode's really setting up the battle, right?
Yeah.
And at this point in the history of the show, Game of Thrones was sort of getting a reputation for not putting any battle scenes on screen.
Mm.
if you think about like all the major battles, like Tyrion gets knocked out and then he wakes up and finds out what happened. You don't really see Jaime captured. You just hear about it. You don't even see Theon go over the walls. He just walks into Bran's bedroom.
Right, that's true.
And I think that this, for the most part, it was a budget thing. Like, it costs a lot of money to film a major Braveheart-style battle scene.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So far, they haven't really proven themselves. But I think that they are setting up for a, you know, a grand finale.
Right.
So do you like that kind of film? Were you a fan of Lord of the Rings, Braveheart, kind of gladiator stuff?
Yeah, I was. But I think I've also become fatigued over the years once you start to see it a lot. I feel like there's not much new under the sun. I remember when first seeing Braveheart, how engrossing the magnitude of that kind of battle was. And then you see it again, and then you see it again. And then by the time I got to the Lord of the Rings, that was the least interesting part for me as a viewer.
Really?
So, I think it's because I had battle scene fatigue.
Uh-huh. I felt that way about Gladiator, because everyone loved Gladiator. And they got pretty creative with...
Well, you don't like Russell Crowe.
I hate Russell Crowe, man.
Even now that he's fat?
I give him a little bit of leeway now that he's fat.
He's real big now.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what I was waiting for. But I only want to see him in scenes that really sort of plays out. Like, I want to see him play Santa or something.
Or at least get out of a chair of labored.
Or Taft. Like, when's the last time you saw a good Taft biopic?
True. Yeah, it just all takes place in the tub.
So you are a little bit, let me put words into your mouth. You have set a really high bar for these sort of medieval battle sequences.
Yeah.
And so next episode, we're going to have to see if it titillates you.
Yeah.
Because there's a good chance that it will not titillate you.
Yeah. And that's, I think, where I'm, like, as I see this coming, I'm kind of like, I'd be all right with if it just goes like 4 days later, you know, or something.
Well, so far, that's what they've done.
Yeah, and I've actually been okay with that. Because, I mean, to me, I probably feel the same way about big battle scenes as I do a lot of the gratuitous sex scenes.
Yeah.
Doesn't add much more to the plot moving forward. And so I find myself kind of like, I need a little more dialogue. I need a little more game playing. And I don't feel like this is moving us closer to that.
Well, yeah. All right. So this episode is all about the dialogue, all about the... putting the pieces in motion, right?
Right.
And another 100% Rotten Tomatoes score. So people are really digging this season back in 2012. And yet they're digging the intrigue more than anything, I think.
Yeah.
And that's probably where you're at, too.
Yeah, I would say so.
All right. Okay. Dany says something that's interesting. She says... the dragons are my children. In fact, they're the only children I'll ever have.
Yeah.
Now, this is something of a divisive topic. Because is she saying, I'll get your take on this, is she saying, my womb is barren? Or is she saying that she's just not interested in letting her womb become a king factory?
That's what I got. Right, because I got the sense at this point that she's not interested in being a queen. She's interested in being the king.
Right, yeah.
Well, okay. Now, while she uses maternal terms constantly with the Mother of Dragons, I think she sees that as beyond a gender role. So I got the sense that it's like, look, yeah, and that, because that's come up a lot, right? I mean, like the previous episode, Cersei and Sansa talking about, you know, children and all of this and that, and there's a burden that goes with it to a certain degree. Your identity is forged into this now, and that's what you've got. That's the only power you have. Now, in this case, the idea of being the Mother of Dragons is like, well, they're my children, they're my power. Not so much the only power I have now is to take care of my children so that they may have power someday. It is, I'm the mother of power.
Yeah.
And I don't have any interest in subjugating to another life.
Yeah, she knows what it's like not to have power.
So I got the sense that it's like, this is it. This is, I'm not going to be, yeah, I'm not here to create a king.
Now, there is another more literal way to read this, because she's had some birthing shenanigans.
True.
And she's had some sort of black sorcery going on with her last pregnancy, and it very well could be that she just doesn't think she's ever going to have a normal baby.
Right.
But you're taking it as it's a choice thing. It's like, look, I'm never going to be that kind of queen.
Right.
Sam needs a toothbrush.
Yeah, boy.
I mean, for a guy that...
Yeah, that guy who just
got a girlfriend. He just got his first girlfriend.
Yeah,
you got to take care of those teeth, man.
Figure it out, man. Just figure it out.
Steve, have you ever baked a pie?
I haven't. I mean, I feel like I've maybe been maybe a sous baker.
A sous chef. You were a sous chef?
Maybe. I mean, like in terms of like helping a pie be baked, but I don't. I cannot take any credit for the actual baking of the pie. I mean, I may have opened the door. And at the request of, does it look done? And then I open it and go, I don't know what I'm looking at.
You know, hot pie is just passionate about pie.
Well, it's in the name. I mean, it'd be weird if it wasn't.
You know, there are names that are ironic nicknames.
True.
But like, I guess Game of Thrones Slim. Really hasn't figured that out yet.
Westeros is a literal region.
It's very literal. The first guy that comes along with an ironic nickname is just going to be the hoot. He's just going to be the toast of the town.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Big guy's going to walk in, they're going to call him Tiny, and everyone's just going to roll on the floor.
Yeah, someone's going to refer to the mountain as the molehill, and everyone's going to be like, what? This is absurd. Have you seen his size? Oh.
Have you ever thought about being a comic in a previous era, Steve?
Like a jester.
Well, see, that's what it would probably be, because you would try to do your stuff,
right?
And they would turn up their noses at you. They wouldn't know what to do with
it. I'd fall, and then bring me the one who falls.
You'd have to know how to juggle. That's you could probably
tired of hearing his phallus jokes.
You could probably do your wine country jokes if, well, juggling.
Yeah, I think so.
They would put up with a lot of wine country jokes.
Yeah, juggling is the great equalizer.
Juggling.
So, interesting you brought up the pie, because a conversation over this last week that I had with some other comics, there's, and I don't know how you feel about this, and I don't want to sidetrack the podcast too much, but, I mean, there are some very strong feelings about pineapple on pizza, for example.
Yeah, it is as divisive as anything that's happening in this country right now.
Right. I mean, it is the defund the police of entrees. So the discussion, you know, is this person very, very anti-pineapple on pie. And he went so far as to say, I hate all hot fruit.
Oh.
So it went beyond the pineapple itself. It went beyond the notion of pizza. But I said, so I take it you don't like pie, so this makes this conversation a little bit more challenging, because, you know, if I'm not saying you have to like pie, but I mean, and he's like, well, I like pie. And I said, well, I'm judging by this that you're only a chocolate cream pie type person, right? Mm-hmm. And I think his intention was like, well, he likes cold pie. And I'm like, well, so you're like hot fruit, just in different stages of hotness. I said, so in that case, you should be okay with cold pineapple pizza. Mm-hmm. And that's where the conversation kind of ended, because
I'll try to be honest on this. I know that I'm probably going to lose half our audience by taking a position on this.
Right. I mean, this is a tough one.
My feeling about pineapple on pizza is that it's a very hipster thing to say. To be against it.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it's not my preferred pizza. I would not prefer pineapple on pizza. And because I'm not eating pizza very often, I would probably not, you know,
You're not going to throw away your pizza in your regard, because
Yeah, I'm not going to waste my carbs on Hawaiian pizza.
Gotcha.
However, I don't feel like making a strong stance on Hawaiian pizza does anyone any good except for to win me hipster points.
Yeah, I would say that that seems...
That said, I do prefer my pie cold.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you don't like it coming right out the oven. You don't go get an apple pie from McDonald's. You don't...
I think that it's not like I would turn up my nose at a hot dessert. But if given the choice, like this just came out of the fridge, I baked it yesterday. Or, you know, this just came out of the oven, I'll take the one out of the fridge.
Okay.
Now, I would prefer cobbler with a scoop of vanilla ice cream.
Would you like it warm?
I would like it warm, yeah.
Yeah, that see, now that's the thing, right? I mean, if it's an a la mode situation, I think one of the overarching appeals to a la mode, not only is ice cream delicious and should be a part of every meal, it's the contrast. Much like the pineapple on the pizza bringing a certain amount of sweetness to something that's a little more salty and savory. And that's why I prefer my pineapple pizza with a little jalapeno in the mix.
Oh my goodness. You've just brought a third way into this argument.
In fact, I believe that the best way to enjoy pineapple on pizza is not with the Canadian bacon option, but with pepperoni and jalapeno.
It's too much, man.
No.
I'm afraid I can't go that far with you. However, if it was just you and me and Night on the Town and you're like, dude, you got to try it, I would not turn it down.
It would change your point of view, I think. I think because you say it's too much and then you realize because you are like, yeah, I like pineapple on pizza. What you think is too much is exactly enough to make pineapple a desirable topping.
Interesting.
That's my case for the day.
I'm an adventurous eater, Steve. I will try new things.
Would you try lamprey pie?
I'll tell you what, hot pie is adventurous too, and I'll tell you why.
I'll go on.
He's suggesting grinding the stone of the cherry.
Right.
And sprinkling it on the crust of the pie. And this is actually a debate in the world of culinary science, because cherry pits do indeed have an enzyme that can become cyanide.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be a little bit poisonous. I don't think that they're poisonous enough to do any real damage to you. And I think that you can cook all the poison out.
Okay.
But I've gone to a few blogs. And I've gone to bonappetit.com. And it seems to me that hot pie is in the right. You can cook with the pits of cherries.
See, hot pie is just sort of considered throwaway. And he's like, oh, he's just got this big appetite. He's a little bit of a gourmand.
He really is. He's a genius that will not be appreciated in his time.
No, I mean, this is, if there was ever a reason to have like another book series.
Ari is just focused on people dying, like murder. She's focused on murder.
Yeah.
And hot pie. Now we could view hot pie differently. We could say, no, he's a much more underhanded character because he's actually poisoning pie.
True. Like maybe he knows a little something about that. He's like, let's just eat to death.
He just likes to hang out. He's not really doing any work. Gendry is like, he's like making horseshoes. Hot pie is just hanging out.
Which is that's what kind of got me. I'm looking at the unsavory tone of this entire area and the awful things they said to Arya, and just in general, it's just mucky. Yet hot pie just seems like what makes hot pie so charming that he could just get is he just keeping these ne'er-do-wells just flush with pie, and they're just like, look, I mean, he hasn't worked like an hour. Man, he does this thing with the cherry stones. I don't even care if it'd kill me. It's delightful.
I really think that if you had skills like of just a moderately talented chef in today's world, you'd be one of the wealthiest people in the world in the ancient world. Because sure. You would have kings and queens demanding your services.
Well, I mean, considering that this entire episode does have a food component to it, I mean, we hear from Stannis about how, Homeboy shows up with something other than rat and dog, and dudes would would give up their vows.
Just for an onion. For an onion.
Yeah.
So this brings me to my next question, right? So Stannis, I think he's been forced into being an adventurous eater. Like, he wouldn't normally eat horse and cat and dog.
I love that. I don't really like cats.
I don't really like cats, so I don't mind eating the cats.
So I'll eat it, because, I mean, they're not my favorites. He dated a woman with a cat that was just real ornery. So he's just like, so every time I just eat it, I think of that cat.
Now tell me, would you consider yourself an adventurous eater? And have you ever been that adventurous?
I consider myself to be relatively adventurous, especially at this age. I mean, earlier I was not. But at this age, I mean, if I'm at a place and someone's like, dude, you got to try this, I more likely than not will try it.
So what would be an example of something that I might guffaw at that you've eaten?
That's a really good question. Yeah, the reason why I think this question is hard to answer now is because I'm just like, I mean, I eat whatever.
You're like, you frequent like food orgies now, so it doesn't
really matter. It's just, I mean, everything is fondue now. I'm mostly fondue. But the thing is, you too, what would you turn your nose up at? Because, I mean, you grew up in the same sort of West Coast sensibility. You may find yourself in the Midwest now, so you may not have as much access. But, I mean, I know you have, you still have the five things you won't eat.
The list is growing smaller. I still will not eat spiders. I would never eat a spider.
Okay. Willingly or knowingly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that I've had my mouth open at night and swallowed something unbeknownst to me.
Yeah, you've eaten spiders. I mean, I just
don't want to know how many.
Yeah, you don't. And that's one of the things, when you get to heaven, it'll be one of the least favorite things you find
out. This is just the idea of knowing that you could find out how many spiders that you've eaten, then it becomes hell.
Right, exactly. See, that's the thing, is you go up there and the thing about heaven is you're there for a minute. I mean, it's a long time. And so
at some point, someone's going to tell you.
You're going to run out of things to talk about. And then you're going to run into that.
Hey, let's go look at the spider book.
Guy's going to come up to you and be like, I know what's on your mind. I can just tell you. And you're like, another time perhaps. And then it's like, you know, an eon later. And he's like, I mean, come on, we've kind of rehashed a lot. We've talked about the girls you could have slept with in high school. The answer is 1,014. And then he walks away. And you're like,
I feel like anything over the teens, and I would just, it would be hell. It would be hell on earth. And over the teens. You know
it. Oh, yeah. It's over the teens. If you're a snorer, you're just sucking in babies.
I did not anticipate this conversation being so horrific.
asked about pie.
Yeah, the pie is a delightful topic, even if it's poison pie. I would eat poison pie before I'd eat a spider.
And that does it for this episode. Electric.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
When we were talking about Bran in our previous conversation, we were talking about how in many ways he's this, you know, very innocent character, but he has this relationship with Hodor that's very
abusive,
right?
Yeah.
It's almost like mind rape. We've been talking about rape, right? So
yeah.
So Hodor sort of gets mind raped, and yet we realize it doesn't sort of turn us against Bran because we're rooting for Bran and we know how powerless Bran is and how, and he's in this really dangerous situation and he doesn't really understand his own power. And I wonder if we should be looking at Dany in the same way. You know, here's someone that's really powerless, who's got a few tricks that she can use, and yet at a time she's going to abuse this power in a way that doesn't necessarily need to turn her evil in our eyes. Yeah. Maybe I'm trying to force an analogy here. I don't know.
No, you're right. You're right. I think one thing, and I'm sure Martin will do it much, much better, but I think what bothered me as a fan of the show and the books, books first and then show, as a woman, as a feminist, as a disability advocate, so many things bothered me about the way in which Dany did what she did in The Bells. And, you know, it's like that moment where the showrunners even described it as her snapping.
Yeah.
Right? That she's on her dragon, they've surrendered, she snaps, she goes crazy, she burns everybody alive. And Dany deserves so much more as a character. I think that that did a disservice to her character. I think it perpetuated some really damaging stereotypes about people with mental disabilities. Huh. I was very concerned about that. It plays into this very tired, boring trope of, again, powerful woman goes crazy.
Yeah.
All kinds of think pieces were written about this. It was just, like you said earlier, that word lazy. It was just lazy,
a lazy
way to do it. So I'm curious to see if we know that that's maybe where Dany will end up, where the power and the adoration skew her so much in terms of her own sense of who she is mm-hmm. and what she's entitled to, mm-hmm. whether she'll be betrayed further, whether who knows. I have faith in Gurm. I have faith that we'll get to a blaze with Danny, that yeah. maybe if it's not the ending we want, because you're right, we're all rooting for Danny, at least in the book version, we're all rooting for Danny. And we were in the show too, to a certain extent. Hopefully we'll get to a place with her that even if we're not happy, it's much more satisfying and much more consistent perhaps. Yeah. And yes, you're right. I mean, from very early on, even in Game of Thrones, you start to see, I call it hubris. It's maybe not hubris yet in a Game of Thrones. It will become elements of that. You see that building, you see moments where she makes these terrible decisions. So yes, there's a history there, but I don't know. I'm not sure what kind of ending I want or expect for her. Yeah, it's not going to be the ending I perhaps wanted initially. I don't think we're going to get that. I'm sort of a romantic. I was hoping that, you know, she and John would live happily ever after. I kind of knew that wouldn't happen, that they wouldn't be able to share the throne and, you know, go on and rule peacefully together. I don't know. What did you imagine in terms of... What did you want, but what did you think would happen? Those are two different things. What did you want for Danny, and then what did you think would happen?
I think I always had a notion in the back of my mind that she was going to have some kind of turn. And I think that there are a lot of indications, little breadcrumbs throughout the books that, you know, she's trying to be a benevolent dictator. Mm-hmm. And of course, dictator's sort of part of that phrase. So I always kind of expected that was going to end up consuming her, that being a benevolent dictator never really works.
Yeah.
I think that that last season should have been twice as long.
Yes.
And they should have really tried to develop her, instead of having her snap, develop her sort of slow descent into this sort of ethical morass where she, yes. where you really believe. Martin's great at creating like an ethical fork where it's yes. like, okay, you do that, that'll be unethical. You do that thing, that'll be more unethical. So which one are you going to choose?
Yes. How much more interesting would that be than yeah. just this idea of, oh, the people don't love me as much as they love John. John doesn't want to be my lover anymore. You know, using Miss Sandy as kind of a plot mm-hmm, point to fuel mm-hmm. her revenge. I mean, there were so many, just like you said, lazy plot points mm-hmm. in the last season, and just tired plot points yeah. that we've seen so many times before. Game of Thrones is better than that. And I agree with you. I would love to see more of that ethical dilemma.
That's right. And that's what Game of Thrones does so well, right?
Yes, the politics of the flaws in her political approach. Mm-hmm. Things that she was starting to learn, certainly when she was in Essos, but then seeing that play out in Westeros. Mm-hmm. And again, I have faith. I think we'll hopefully get there if we ever get the last two books. Poor Martin. I'm sure he's so badgered at this point.